Okay, we're holding Parshas Vayeshev, part 2. What have we seen so far? We've seen some problematic relationship between Yosef and his siblings. A special garment was given by Yaakov to Yosef, and the brothers have heard Yosef's dreams. They are upset by them. And when Yosef comes to check how they're doing out in Shechem, they decide that he is deserving of the death penalty, and they strip him naked, throw him in a pit, and sell him as a slave to be brought down to Egypt. They get 20 coins, they each buy a set of shoes. They come back to the father, and they bring back the torn up garment with blood. They say, "This is what we found. Is this your son's garment?" And he says, "Yeah, it's my son's garment. Yosef was gorged, he was destroyed." Thank you. And everyone tries to comfort Yaakov, and Yaakov refuses to be comforted. Yaakov says, "I will mourn to the grave. Till I go meet my son in the grave, I will mourn." And he cries. Why is Yaakov mourning so? We know that a person is supposed to limit his mourning. So our sages say that God made a special blessing in the world that when a person passes away, we can forget the person after 11, 12 months. And that's why the mourning goes down, because we forget. That's a blessing God put in the world. But God only gave this blessing for people who die. Yosef did not die. So Yaakov didn't have this blessing. So the pain just wouldn't go away. He would remember Yosef. God made it that we forget someone who dies. Yosef isn't dead. Why nonetheless did Yaakov cognizantly say, "I will mourn to the grave"? Because Yosef, he thought, was murdered, was killed, as a youngster, 17 years old. And we know that in heaven they don't take a person to task till he's 20 years old. A person does not get killed for sins that are between him and heaven till he is 20. Until 20, our parents, so to speak, foot the bill. That's why some had the custom to say, "Baruch sheptarani me'onsho shel zeh," when the child has his 20th birthday. The parent says, "Thank God, I no longer have to worry about him carrying the weight of my sins." Now the Torah records, "Vayered Yehuda met echav." Yehuda went down from the brothers. The brothers turned to Yehuda when they saw Yaakov mourning like this. They said, "You told us to sell him. If you would have told us to bring him back home to dad, we would have listened." Now why is this recorded here? We mentioned last time that it seems to be out of order. One understanding is that the Torah is coming to stress the reason that Yehuda was brought down, he went down from the brothers, was because they sold Yosef. Another understanding is that Yehuda told his father, "You recognize this?" And here in this whole story, Tamar is going to tell Yehuda, "You recognize this?" The signs to show us that God pays people back. With the same term, he told his father to take a look at the torn garments with blood, that's the same term that he was told to look at the signs that he's really the one that impregnated Tamar. Another understanding is that the Torah is aligning Yosef's descent with Yehuda's descent. We have here two forces are working within Judaism. We have the force of Yosef. Yosef comes with his dreams, "I'm going to rule, I'm going to have everyone bow to me, I'm going to be king." And the brothers say, "Yehuda's supposed to run the show. Yehuda's the king. Yosef, this is you're rebelling against the kingdom within Judaism." And Yosef says, "I see in my dreams that even in the times of Messiah, the Messiah that comes from me will be first." And in truth, it's true. Our first king was from Binyamin, not from Yosef, but the first king was not from Yehuda. And it was from the sons of Rachel. It was from Binyamin. And Mashiach ben Yosef will come first. So when Yosef gets put down, Yosef gets sent down to Egypt as a slave, The brothers say, let's see you be king out of this. And they sell him down as a slave to Egypt. Yehuda also gets taken down. Yehuda gets down. The brothers tell him, you no longer have your position of authority. You told us to sell down Yosef. You're the one that caused us to cause this great grief to dad. You're no longer king. And the fourth understanding that's brought is that the story is written here because directly following the story, we will follow Yosef into Egypt and find him in the house of Potiphar. And we will find how Potipharah tries to take him, and we see a relationship almost forming that is very improper. Yeharig v'alyaver. Yosef should rather get killed than allow himself to fall into that trap. And our sages have a tradition that Potiphar's wife, her intent was for good. She wanted to have children from this pious person. She wanted to have the continuum of Yosef's family be from her, and she was right. Yosef ultimately married her daughter. She was wrong in trying to do it herself, but her intent was for good. And our sages say that these two stories were written together. This story of Yehuda is recorded here to tell us, just like you see from this story, that Tamar had good kosher intent. Tamar wanted to merit to marry into Yaakov's family, to marry into Yehuda. So too, Potiphar's wife had good intent. Yehuda marries the daughter of a Canaanite. And the question is, what's he doing marrying the daughter of a Canaanite? So one understanding is that he was a merchant. Canaan means a merchant. Canaan is Canaan literally is the balance, the scale that they'd weigh out their wares. And Canaan is one who's a merchant, who sells wares. So one understanding is that Yehuda married the daughter of a merchant. Another understanding is that really Yehuda erred. He married the daughter of a Canaanite. And that is why Yehuda ultimately, he saw his sons from this woman, they weren't fit. The sons sinned. The sons all died. God wasn't happy with these children. So this woman, Yehuda's wife, they have a child. The first child he names Er. The second child she names Onan. And here we see that the customs in those times were that they used to divide it. The father would name the first child, the mother would get to choose the second child. And on the third child it says that Yehuda was away, so she named the child. So they ask, why didn't she wait? So I could tell you that when I had a baby girl, so the custom is that you name a girl in shul when you make a mishaberach. So if the baby is born on a Friday, so you do it on Shabbos. What happens if, like my daughter, the baby is born on a Tuesday or a Wednesday? So then you reach the Torah reading on Thursday before Shabbos. Do you name the baby then or not? So my feeling was that we should name her sooner rather than later, because I want to include her in my prayers. And it's easier to include her in prayers if she has a name. If I want people to pray for her, well, if she has no name, what are they going to say? Netanel's daughter. So it's a possibility, but she was my only daughter. So that's why I wanted to name her earlier. And afterwards I found out that Rav Moshe Feinstein also told people that they should name people and that they should name their daughter earlier rather than later. Better than wait for Shabbos, better name her on the Monday or the Thursday, the earlier opportunity that one has. So according to that, we can understand why Yehuda's wife didn't wait for him. He was out of town. He was out in Kziv when she gave birth. So she named the child. She named the last child Sheva. Yehuda takes a wife for his son. And here we see that parents should try and help their children get married. Yehuda gets involved. He takes a wife for his eldest son. And the Torah tells us his eldest son was sinful and God killed him. So Yehuda tells the second son, you marry her, you do Yibum. That way there'll be children to name after your brother, to continue your brother's name. And Onan knows that if he marries his brother's wife, then the children won't really be his. They'll be like his brother's children. So he destroys his sperm to the ground. so that he doesn't have children, he can't impregnate his wife. And when God sees this, so God kills him as well. And our sages say this gives us insight as to what Er's sin was. His elder brother Er did the same thing. He said, why should my wife get pregnant? Er was all 7 or 9 years old, probably 7. He said, I want a beautiful wife. I got a beautiful Tamar as my wife. Let her stay beautiful. Why does she need to get pregnant? So he'd also ensure that she wouldn't get pregnant. And here it's important to mention that we are forbidden from destroying our seed. It's one of the biblical prohibitions. And this includes even in a roundabout way, meaning one, the Gemara says, may not have improper thoughts by day, which will cause him to emit seed by night, because one is not allowed to cause it to happen. Not only is one not allowed to do it with his own hands. So Yehuda tells Tamar, he tells her, he doesn't know what went on between Er, Onan, and Tamar. He just knows that he married 2 sons to this woman who seems to be tzedekes. According to one tradition, she was the daughter of Shem, which would put her at about 175 years old. So how does such a woman marry 7 years old is a question, and why they thought they could have kids with her is another question, and why Yehuda thought to marry them to such a woman is a really good question. But she was a big tzedekes, but why would Yehuda think she could have kids? So this medrash is problematic, but at any rate, we know Tamar was a pious woman, as she proved herself later in this parsha. So Yehuda's wife passes away, and Yehuda goes up to shear his sheep, and Tamar sees that Yehuda hasn't kept his end of the deal. So Tamar takes off her clothing that she wore as a widow, that showed that she was waiting for a husband, for Shela, and she wore some beautiful scarf, and she went to the path where she knew Yehuda would pass. We have a tradition that when Yehuda passed her, he passed, and the Malach came and slapped him and threw him back, and Malach sent him back, and he stood before her, and this angel wanted this to happen. So Yehuda thinks that she's a woman for hire, and he tells her, let's get together. And she says, what will you give me? And Yehuda says, I'll send you some sheep, I'll send you a young goat. And she says, give me collateral. And she says, give me your staff, give me your special ring, give me your special personal stuff that'll show it to you. He gives it to her, and they're together. Now, what was his intent when he gave it to her? As collateral for something more valuable to her, for the young goat. In those times, we know that the concept of marriage was very free. The Rambam explains that in those times, you want to be with a woman, then you meet her in the street, say, hey, want to get together? She says yes, you say yes. You could go into the house and live together as husband and wife. You want to go, you could go. She wants to go, she could go. The concept of marriage is an institution of the Torah. The Torah tells us that we have something holy called marriage and something with permanence. But until the Torah was given, we weren't obligated to permanence, and the Torah didn't expect it. The Torah said, you want to get together, you want to leave. And that's exactly what happened here. Yehuda told her, you want to, let's get together. She agreed. Yehuda promised to send her something, and he kept his word. He sent her a good young goat, and she isn't waiting around for Yehuda. Yeah?
Sorry, why is it Yehuda's Torah different than our Torah?
Well,
they do the whole Torah.
So, let's get back to that in a minute, okay? Yeah.
So, basically, you're saying is that anytime a man has relations with a woman, it's considered marriage. Was considered marriage back then.
It seems that way. It seems that if it was with both of their consent, that was what marriage was about. In different classes, we discuss different opinions, but that's one opinion. Yes.
So you write it in the last class, in the previous class, that you mentioned that. It was, they were engaged.
There is an opinion that says that when he told her, let's get together, he meant let's get together and get married. And she said, fine, what are you going to give me? And he said, I don't have anything of that's valuable enough to engage you with now. I'll give you these as collateral that I will send you something more valuable, namely a young goat, which he did. There is an understanding that says that what took place here was marriage. That we know that an important person is not supposed to travel with less than two people. Yehuda had his two people with him. They were the witnesses. And he engaged her at this point. There is that understanding in this story as well. But the psukim are indicative otherwise. It says, Ve'achsheveh lezonah, the pasuk says. That's why it's a more problematic understanding. The second thing that I said was the Rambam in Mor Nebuchim and the Rambam in Ishus in the beginning of the laws of marriage. So Yehuda finds out, he sends his friend with a good goat to collect the collateral, and Tamar isn't around. So they ask, hey, where's the woman for hire that used to sit around here? And they say that there wasn't such a woman here, and Yehuda tells him, look, we tried our best. Now, let's not publicize it. It's not something to be proud about, what happened then. After 3 months, Yehuda gets word that Tamar is pregnant. She was unfaithful. And Yehuda says, okay, according to the times, as we discussed earlier today, we had seen from last week's parsha that after the act of Shechem, the whole population of the land of Israel had seen a downfall. There was rampant misbehavior when it came to women in the land of Israel, and this expanded to the point that God said these nations have to be kicked out and the people of Israel will inherit the land of Israel. Yehuda says, according to the acceptable law at this point, she deserves the death penalty of burning. And she sees that she's being taken out to be burned. Our sages say she went to get Yehuda's signet ring, his staff. She went to get the special signs to send Yehuda. Along came the Malach of Esav and hid them. And she looks for them and she can't find them. She wants to send them to Yehuda. And along comes Gabriel, the Malach of Israel, and he brings them back. And she sends them to Yehuda. And she says, look, the guy who owns these, he's the father of the kids. And why did she say it this way? She could have just said, Yehuda, you're the father. Because she said, I know I'm being taken out to be burnt. If he wants, I'll admit. If he wants, he doesn't. Better allow myself to be burnt than to embarrass a person publicly. And we derive this from here. A person should rather let himself fall into a burning furnace than to embarrass someone. There's a story of an old rabbi who once came to shul, and he came early, and he saw that the shul was cold, so he went to get some logs to throw into the fire. And he was arranging the logs in the fire, and in walks in the shamish, and he sees an old man, he sees someone bent into the furnace, so he sees the guy bent in, can't resist, walks behind and gives him a wham on the behind. Now the rabbi, he realizes that whoever did it didn't realize it was him. But he doesn't want to turn around. He doesn't want to embarrass the shamish. So he kept his head inside until the shamish walked away. And when he walked away, most of his beard had already been consumed by the fire. So he put out the fire and he went to pray. And this is a true story. This is in true keeping with this tradition that he preferred not to embarrass the guy than to he let himself lose his beard. Yeah, sorry.
I have a few things though. One, since the person she was avoiding embarrassing was not just any old person, was the person who would be responsible. Wait, that's right. The person she would be embarrassing, she would be embarrassing the person who would be responsible for her death had she chosen to die rather than embarrass. Therefore, it seems rather illogical to say that you should prefer to die wrongly by someone's hand. And I mean, like, because, like, why should you want to avoid embarrassing a murderer? or someone who you see as a murderer. I mean, she knows that she's not wrong.
So he's still not a murderer.
If I'm saying in her eyes, he would be the wrongful executor of her.
His silence is what would kill her.
That is true. The point is that she could have said, mm-hmm. he did it. She did it.
Yeah.
She was already being taken out to the gallows. She said, wait. She didn't know if they would wait. Mm-hmm. When she was taken out to the gallows, her first response could have been, wait, he did it. She didn't say that. She said, ask him. The one who did this is responsible.
Mm-hmm.
From that we inferred.
But also, how do we know that she wasn't doing it? Because she knew that he would...
Even if she knew he would admit, she didn't know at that given moment that they would detain the gallows for her.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she didn't say that.
But here's what I'm imagining.
Let's say he wouldn't have admitted, would she have said it was him?
Maybe.
I don't know. Okay, I'm saying, I think we derive it from the fact that on the moment, she didn't say, don't take me out to the gallows, he did it. But rather on the moment, she said, the guy, send this to you the first. The guy who did it. Now they could have said, no, you go out to the gallows. And she risked that. She risked the people taking her out to the gallows. I think that we can understand that that's the point. But maybe not. I don't know.
Maybe.
We have to look at the Gemara. We have to see the words.
It's like I'm wondering, maybe she said, like, stop. I have proof. I have exoneration. Talk to Yehuda Hill.
I don't know. The Gemara does derive this. So I don't know. We have to look at the Gemara. When we learn Sota, so you'll see why not. So, bottom line, she has twins, and from these twins come David HaMelech, from Peretz. Now, what went on here? Why did it have to take this fashion? So our sages say that a person cannot take a position of leadership in Judaism unless he has a pile of shkatzim, despicable little creepy crawly creatures on his back. What does that mean? A person always has to have a history. If a person wants to take a position of leadership and he was born to a good family and he was always a good person and no one has anything bad to say about him, so then he'll say, hey, I'm the leader. This is what I say. This is how I've been brought up. Look at what a fine person I am. And he'll feel like he has a right to tell people what to do. So we have a tradition that God always ensures that when we have a really, really great leader who has to do exceptional things, he should have a history. So that people will tell him, you want to open your mouth? You come from... We know the whole true story. And that's why God wanted to ensure that David HaMelech has that. The whole Davidic dynasty has that. That they would never be able to say, we're from David. And God will say, you're from David in whom? You're from David from the story of Tamar. Everyone knows that story, what went on there. You're from David? We know you're from Ruth. From the whole story of Rus and Boaz. And we know that story that went on there. And our sages said that this was a way of ensuring that the greatest leaders would be modest. Yeah?
Are there people who derive from that basically everyone should have the right to knowledge, but everyone should be Baal Teshuva, and no one should be from birth.
That we will discuss in Mitzshem in Parshas Shmos. A person should be from birth, but a person shouldn't feel that just because he's a Baal Teshuva he can't attain a position of leadership. If he's coming and he has a history, so every great leader had a history. If he himself won't be a great leader, then maybe his children, his grandchildren. We don't aspire to have history, but we don't look at a history as something that means that we can't have a future. A history might be just in order to ensure that we'll have a future. The history is one of the tools that God gave us. Okay, we're out of time. We're going to just end with a quick overview of what happens. Yosef is taken down to Egypt. He's sold to Potiphar. Potiphar purchases him. He sees a beautiful looking guy. He can't have wife with his. He can't have kids with his wife. He really takes Yosef, thinking that he's going to have him to himself. And God sends an angel down to castrate Potiphar. And then Potiphar's wife finds Yosef to be exceptionally good looking, and she tries to take him. Our sages say that this was an exceptional test, and this goes back to what we discussed, if you recall, in the last week on Tanat Be'elio, that there are two paths. We said there are two good paths. There's the path of tzedakah and there's the path of chesed. And when we describe the path of tzedakah, we describe that we describe doing the letter of the law. And when we said it, I felt like we didn't give it enough justice, that the letter of the law sometimes is very, very, very difficult to maintain. Yosef is called Yosef HaTzadik because he maintained that path, the letter of the law. To be within his master's home, and day after day his master's wife is trying to get him to maintain the letter of the law at those times in life, that's very difficult. Yosef saw that he, in going with her, he would forsake God and he would also forsake his fellow man. And we have to know that the test that Yosef stood up against is a test that's found throughout life. It's a test that began with Yosef, but in truth, Jews are faced up to this test many times. The Gemara records that there were Amoraim who were tested so, and a person has to learn this parasha and learn from Yosef to avoid tests, and if unfortunately a person finds himself in the test, to take the strength from Yosef to stand up to the test. May we all stand up to our tests and have a beautiful Hanukkah, enjoy the sweet latkes, enjoy the sufganiyot, and I hope to see all of you in Mitzvah on Sunday.